Many thanks for that beautiful music. Thank you both. I'll be reading the scripture from John 18, verse 36. Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not from this world. If my kingdom were from this world, my followers would be fighting to keep me from being handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not from here."
Good morning. Beth asked me to say a bit about how I got interested in this subject before I launched into this. I actually started learning about this when I got access to my grandfather's letters in the mid-70s. He was a conscientious objector during World War I. He was a sophomore at Goshen College when he was called up to join the Army. And he was later furloughed to the American Friends Service Committee and did relief and reconstruction work in France in 1919. And you'll see some photos of him in the PowerPoint that Melinda's going to share with us. And you'll also see a group picture of the Mennonites who were serving with the American Friends Service Committee in 1919, doing relief and reconstruction work in France at the end of the war. I'm currently revisiting all of this material as associate producer for a documentary series called The Mennonite Experience in America, working with Burton Buller in preparing what we hope will be a public broadcasting program on not just World War I, but World War I was significant in that it was in some ways a wake-up call for the Mennonite Church in terms of its peace position. And I'm going to stick pretty close to my script because as a professor, I was used to 50 to 75 minutes. And so this has been a real discipline for me to try to do this in 15. So we'll see. Hear these words written by Mennonites to the Commission on Military, National, and Public Service. Greetings in the name of Jesus. It is with deep gratitude that we have the freedom and privilege to express our firmly held Christian beliefs to our government. As Anabaptist Christians, we have often experienced our relationship with the United States government as a blessing. In that, we have been granted freedom to follow Christ according to our consciences. Following the teaching in Matthew 5, we are called to love our enemies, do good to those who hate us, pray for those who persecute us, refuse to violently resist the evildoer, and forgive as we have been forgiven. As conscientious objectors, we believe Jesus commands reverence for every human life, since every person is made in the image of God. And in following Jesus, we serve in ways that build up, nurture, and encourage rather than destroy. Our opposition to war is not cowardice, but an expression of Christ's forgiving love as shown on the cross. We see ourselves as ambassadors of peace. In November 1916, Woodrow Wilson was re-elected president based on his promise to keep the United States out of the European war. But by April 1917, the war to make the world safe for democracy had been declared, and the government began an unprecedented public relations effort to build and sustain public support for the war effort. And you'll see some of those posters. The Committee for Public Information mounted 36 different campaigns in multiple languages to convince Americans to support the military draft, buy liberty bonds, and ration food. Government propaganda demonized the enemy and fueled anti-German sentiment. Campaigns of fear and intimidation, loyalty leaks, and surveillance laws, like the Espionage Act and later the Sedition Act, forbade activities such as obstructing the armed forces' recruitment, making false statements on the sale of war bonds, and the law imposed penalties on uttering, printing, writing, or publishing any disloyal, scurrilous, or abusive language about the government, the flag, the Constitution, and the military uniform. Just 1 month after the declaration of war, the passage of the Selective Service Act, all males between the ages of 21 and 31 were required to register for the draft. Despite Quaker and Mennonite advocacy for an exception for recognized sects whose creed forbade participation in war, the law provided for an exemption only from combat, and noncombatant service was not defined in the law. Newton Baker, the Secretary of War, encouraged Wilson to delay defining noncombatancy in an effort to discourage claims for such service. Less than a month later, on June 5, 1917, it was the National Day of Registration, and 10 million American men were signed up for the military service. Over the next 18 months, 2.8 million men were sent to military camps, including Amish, Hutterites, Mennonites, Brethren, and Quakers, who were conscientious objectors. My grandfather, John Zimmerman, was one of them. He was inducted into the Army in April of 1918, and later he was furloughed to France to do reconstruction work with the American Friends Service Committee. Mennonites and Quakers desperately sent delegations to Washington to reiterate their refusal to participate in war and advocating that COs be permitted to perform alternate forms of service. In August of 1917, the Mennonite Church Assembly, representing 16 church districts across the country, passed a resolution stating, "We cannot participate in war in any form, that is, to aid or abet war, whether in combat or noncombatant capacity." That resolution requested that draftees be held in special detention camps, that they did not have to wear uniforms or drill, and that they did not have to serve in any capacity that violated their conscience. The Mennonites also created a War Problems Committee to advocate on behalf of draftees and appointed Bishop Aaron Laux from this area to visit men in camps. Later, Bishop Laux and all 181 signatories to that resolution were investigated for violations of the Espionage Act. The War Department was concerned about the numbers of objectors, so military intelligence began surveillance of Hutterites, Mennonites, and the Amish as dangerous, disruptive, and unpatriotic. The chief of the Bureau of Investigation suspected that, quote, "Mennonites might be a covert front for a pro-German underground." The final report concluded, "As farmers, the Mennonites are 100% efficient. As militants, 100% deficient. The individual Mennonite draftee is bigoted, pig-headed, ignorant, unaccustomed to thinking for himself. Whether a sincere objector or just plain yellow need not concern us here. He is, at any rate, mighty poor material for the Army." When Wilson finally defined noncombatant service nearly a year later, his order defined it as service within the medical, quartermaster, or engineering corps, all units within the military establishment. He also ordered again the segregation of COs and forbade the infliction of punitive hardship of any kind. But by then, COs in camps across the country had been harassed, jailed, and court-martialed for resisting participation in the military. Upon arrival in camp, COs were counseled to inform authorities that they could not consent to service within the military, neither combatant nor non-combatant. And they submitted their church membership certificates and, in some cases, documents showing that their local draft boards had recognized their noncombatant stance. But in many cases, especially during the first 6 months of the mobilization, their claims were ignored. By October 1917, the military commanders were ordered to segregate COs, but in many camps, the order was never enforced, or COs were never informed that there were segregated units. Orders to treat COs with tact and consideration were ignored in many camps. Camp officers' primary goal was to persuade all men to become regular soldiers. Failing that, to become non-combatants who would wear the uniform, drill, and perform Army work. Many officers were hostile and considered COs slackers, yellow bellies, or enemy aliens. COs faced three challenges when they got to camp. One, to wear or resist wearing the uniform. Two, to refuse or to participate in drills carrying a weapon, and then three, to decide what work, if any, to accept in camp. The pressure to submit to military participation was unrelenting. Many were harassed and physically forced into uniforms by their tent mates. COs were told they were the only COs in the camp of thousands to pressure them. Some were marked with an E for enemy and forced to stand outside in the weather. Others were forced to stand in the center of camp reading aloud from their Bibles in front of hundreds of jeering soldiers. Those who refused non-combatant roles provoked the military the most. They endured physical, verbal, and mental abuse. Hot or cold showers, dunking, beating, kicking, lashing, wounding with bayonets, and imprisonment. Some were forced to drill with rifles strapped to their backs. Others had their clothing taken in an attempt to force them into the uniform. The worst treatment included exhaustion drills, torture, mock executions by hanging and firing squad, being buried alive, cesspool baptisms, severe beatings, and solitary confinement. What the National Civil Liberties Bureau investigation into military abuses called clean torture. To address the persistent problems of COs in camps, the Secretary of War appointed a board of inquiry in June 1918 to determine the sincerity of each CO and decide his fate. The three-member panel included two, Major Kellogg and Stone, who suspected that objectors were of inferior intelligence. Kellogg wrote that the Mennonite objector shuffles awkwardly into the room. He seems only half awake. His features are heavy, dull, and almost bovine. Kellogg thought Mennonites were unworthy of being American citizens. Stone wrote that they were, quote, a depressing example of dense ignorance of what is going on in the world. Psychological testing proved otherwise. During the summer of 1918, the Secretary of War ordered psychological examinations of over 1,000 objectors. The results showed that COs scored higher than most other draftees on tests of intelligence, and that some indeed were keen thinkers. The researchers reported, "There is absolutely nothing in these data to justify the hasty conclusion that objection to war is due to low mentality. It can safely be said that at least 97% of the conscientious objectors have sufficient intelligence to know what they are doing." Objectors were not simply pro-German, the report went on. They were most likely, in the case of the Mennonites, born on a farm, educated to the eighth grade, attended church, respected their ministers, and had information limited to their own community. For a man like this not to be a conscientious objector would violate all the laws of heredity and environment, the psychologists found. The Board of Inquiry traveled across the country to military camps to examine the 2,100 objectors that were detained in Army camps. J.C. Meyer was one of them, a Harvard-educated Ohio Mennonite. He recalled the questions that he was asked by the board. Do you use liquor or alcohol? Do you use profane language? Do you live a pure sex life? Are you a member of the church? Do you get angry? Are you afraid of death? Do you feel you can do more good by not taking a life? Meyer wrote, Major Kellogg was hell-bent on shaming men out of their declared convictions. Kellogg later told Meyer that he was far too intelligent to waste his talents on conscientious objection. Meyer was later furloughed to work in France with the American Friends Service Committee. Of the 2,100 COs examined by the board, 1,500 received furloughs, including many Mennonites. 88 were recommended for service with the American Friends Service Committee, and these are the Mennonites who were in France in 1919. 390 were ordered to take up non-combatant duty, and 120 were deemed insincere and assigned to combat duty. Overall, there were about 21,000 COs inducted into the Army, and some 80% agreed to take up arms. Only 3,989 men held fast to their convictions against military participation. Of those, 504 were court-martialed for disobeying orders, including 142 Mennonites. COs represented 0.14% of the 2.8 million men inducted. As the pressure to conform ramped up in the camps, camp commanders used court-martials as a coercion technique. Half of the 504 COs who received courts-martial were tried between May and June of 1918. Most objectors were charged with a willful disobedience of a lawful order, and commanders could decide whether they were going to press this issue, but if they refused to wear a uniform, drill, or perform duties, that could be the basis for a charge if the commander so chose. While objectors had the right to counsel, few were represented during their trials, and ultimately their sentences ranged from 1 to 40 years in prison. One example, John Neufeld. John was a Kansas pastor's son of Russian Mennonite roots, and he'd spent several years working as a missionary, erecting buildings for Native American missions. He was called up in June of 1918 and sent to Camp Cody, New Mexico, with his cousin, where they endured both physical and verbal abuse. At first, John cut wood and drilled, but when weapons were introduced, they refused to drill and were beaten for disobeying and sent to the stockade. About 2 weeks later, Neufeld was tried on July 17, 1918, and determined to be insincere and sentenced to hard labor. He was then sent to the federal penitentiary at Leavenworth, where he was placed in what was called the 5th Gang, a unit of COs who could be trusted to work outside the prison wall doing farm work. When he and 13 others refused to work on a Sunday, their hands were manacled to posts. He suffered from flu and diphtheria, but he survived, and he was released after 6 months in prison. After his release, he went on to study architecture. He married and was an ordained pastor in the Mennonite Bible Mission in Chicago. There were 45 Mennonites in Camp Travis, Texas, who were sentenced to 25 years each in June of 1918 and then imprisoned at the penitentiary at Leavenworth. None had appeared before the Board of Inquiry. By the end of 1918, there were 135 court-martialed Mennonites imprisoned at Leavenworth, where conditions were brutal and violent. Those who refused to work received the harshest treatment, while those who worked on the prison farm had it somewhat easier. The National Civil Liberties Bureau investigated conditions of COs imprisoned at Leavenworth and Fort Jay, and they challenged the use of dark cells, the practice of manacling, and a diet of bread and water for prisoners in solitary confinement. They argued in a memo to Newton Baker that such treatment was torture and abhorrent to the American spirit. Prisoners who refused to work spent half their time in isolation and half in an alternative lockup. At Leavenworth, the solitary cells were in a sub-basement, where they were handcuffed and chained to bars, at least sometimes for 9 hours a day, receiving only bread and water. In some cases, they were kept in solitary for 30 to 50 days in a row. In December of 1918, Secretary of War Baker ordered that no prisoners should be fastened to bars of cells, but by then, two Hutterite brothers had died under these conditions. And by the way, their bodies were sent home in military uniforms. After the armistice, COs in camps and prison were in limbo. The National Civil Liberties Board advocated for their release and furlough, and most were released by February of 1919. Nevertheless, some COs died in camp of the Spanish influenza epidemic that swept through in 1918. And when they did return, some men were received with hostility in their home communities. The experiences of COs in military camps attest to the high personal cost of war. They were treated as criminals, separated from wives and families, humiliated and abused, and they suffered a loss of innocence about their country and their church. Many lost friends in camp as well as family members at home due to the flu epidemic and other causes. Young Mennonites like my grandfather, who was furloughed to France with the Friends Service Committee to do reconstruction, came home with a vision for a more active pacifism. They came home with a passion to alleviate post-war suffering, and they came home with hopes for greater inter-Mennonite cooperation. They also had a renewed commitment to Christian education and service. And both Mennonite Central Committee and Mennonite World Conference were created shortly thereafter in fulfillment of such dreams. When World War II came along, Mennonites were better prepared. They had developed more peace education. They had developed broader cooperation among Anabaptists and peace groups. And they were better organized in their advocacy for alternative service. And so in World War II, we had civilian peace service as an alternative for conscientious objectors that was not part of the military. Let me return to the letter that I began with to the members of the Commission on Military, National, and Public Service. They wrote, "As churches in the Anabaptist tradition, we stand firmly with those Christians throughout history who by conscience were not able to participate in the military. One of the important reasons our spiritual ancestors migrated from Europe was for religious freedom, which included not participating in military service. They believed that the state should not coerce in matters of religious conviction, and they understood Jesus' teaching to mean that his followers would not join or support armed resistance, but would overcome evil with good." This letter could have been written in 1917, but it is dated, September 13, 2019. It was sent by 13 Anabaptist church groups to an independent U.S. federal agency established in Congress in 2017 with a charge to review the Selective Service Registration in the event of military draft, and particularly to decide whether women should be required to register. Also, they were charged to recommend ways to increase participation in the military, national, and public service. This commission received public comment until December 31st, 2019, the last day of last year, and is expected to make its recommendations to Congress this spring, 2020. The letter includes 9 specific recommendations or responses to the commission's interim recommendations that they made, and it requests that no law be enacted to require universal obligation for men or women to participate in the military, and it recommends that women not be required to register. The letter also requests that the Selective Service continue to be civilian-led and continue to maintain protections for alternate service programs for conscientious objectors. I encourage you to pay attention to the work of this commission and its recommendations coming in the spring, and also to become informed about Anabaptist advocacy for conscientious objection. As Mennonites in 1917 learned, conditions and public sentiment can change quickly. Do we know the stories of those conscientious objectors in our family circles? Are we prepared to stand for peacemaking and service? In what ways? Have we educated ourselves and our children to respond to a call for war and to stand for peace? Lest we assume the experiences of conscientious objectors in 1918 and 1917 are a closed chapter in our history, I think we need to think again. Blessed are the peacemakers.